CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 170, with Dr. William Tanure, Resilience, Martial Arts, Mastering Surgical Complications. This is a really fun episode. You're going to love it.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest from Brazil. That's Dr. William Tanure. Welcome to our podcast.
Thanks, doctor. Thanks for having me.
For sure. Now, we first, I guess, interacted years ago when you sent me an email about a video I produced or put on Cataract Coach, and you were surprised that I replied.
Yes, I did. And you also, you replied a lot faster than I expected, so I found that awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, unfortunately, I spend too much time on my computer. That's the problem here. Now, tell me about your path in ophthalmology. How'd you choose ophthalmology? What was your background? Where do you train? What do you do now?
Okay, long story short, my father is an ophthalmologist here in my city. And
city is?
Petrópolis, it's in the state of Rio de Janeiro.
Okay.
Okay, and since I was a young one, I experienced a lot of ophthalmology because of his private practice. And I remember that when I was kind of 5 or 6 years old, my mom used to drive us school to his office, and we wait here till he stopped doing the practice on that day. And I remember that I tended to invade his office and to play with this lit lamp. I love the joystick. And I thought, oh, this looks like some kind of video game. So, and when I asked him about the slit lamp, and he told me, oh, we use this device to examine people's eyes. So I find that awesome. And some years later, he returned home, and he showed us a videotape. The younger ones, they don't know what is this nowadays. And he showed me an extracapsular surgery. So I found it fascinating, that thing coming out of the eye with that big incision. And I said, I want to do this for the rest of my life. So when I started med school, I had no plan B. I just wanted to be an ophthalmologist, and that's it. So I graduated in kind of like 2005 and started my residency in the next year.
Okay, so you've been in practice now then more than 10 years, quite a while.
It's like I finished a residency, it's like 2008, so it's kind of almost 20 years to now.
Wow, the years go by fast. Sometimes you don't realize.
Yeah, a lot fast than we expected, yeah.
Right, like I can't believe that I'm on the second half of my career. Because right, when you're a resident, you're doing your residency, your fellowship, your training, you think, oh God, it takes forever, so many years. But when you start to practice, it goes fast.
Yeah, and I think one of the many ironies we had in life is we think that the current phase we're living in is like the most difficult phase that you live in your life. But the next one is a lot harder. And when we're in residency, and it said, oh, we were learning about cataract, so difficult, we have to train a lot, we have to do anything, study a lot. And when you finish your residency and you went to your private practice, you find out that it's a lot harder than it.
Right. I always jokingly say, when I was in my last year of training 20 years ago more, okay, I thought to myself, I am so ready to be in private practice, because private practice will be so much easier. And of course, it's much harder.
Yeah, we think it's kind of like a kind of paradise, but your responsibilities, they up so much. So, and you have so many more problems and so many complex problems than you had before. And I think you said it in one of your videos. One of the problems you have, you can't run to your professor now. Okay, so if you had some kind of problem in your office or in your surgical room, the problem is you don't have the professor. It's up to you to solve the problem, solve the issue.
Yes, for sure. I say, when you're in your practice in the future, I tell the residents, when you're in the future, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you'll have a complication, a bad problem, and you look to your left in the operating room, and you look to your right, and there's
nobody.
Left.
He's there's just nobody.
Right.
Yeah, there's nobody. And also, one of the problems I used to tell residents these days, people tend to think that when you finish the residency, residency, you're completely be capable of solving all the issues you came by. And most of the issues, you learn it the hard way, okay? You have to deal with the problem on that. You have to deal with that hand and you have to solve it. So you're not fully ready to do, especially surgery. It's a thing that most of them, they don't understand. They think, I'm going to finish residency and, okay, I'm ready. I can do it. And no, you do know some surgery and you do have some experience, but you're not a problem solver, as I used to tell them. To be a problem solver, to be the one who doesn't look after your professor, you have to take some more years in practice.
That is very true. Very, very true. You'll learn more in your first 5 years of practice than all of your residency and fellowship combined. Residency fellowship only teaches you the very basics. That's it.
Yes. Yeah. And when you have some kind of the main issue in regarding surgeries in residency is the complication things. Okay. Especially capsular rupture. Okay. So when you have those complications in residency, you had a professor to help you solve them, okay? Right. And after that, as I said before, you don't have this one. So when you have the those complications, and you have to deal with them. And also, I'd like to say, if you have some kind of problem and you need another ophthalmologist, another specialty to deal with your problem, just kind of retinal specialist, I refer to you and please solve it for me. And when you're in your private practice, the patient, you can call, of course, other specialists, but the patient looks to you and say, doctor, how can you solve it? So the responsibility ups a lot, and it's a main issue that's a lot of people have difficulties to deal with.
Yeah, these are such important kind of philosophical issues that we sometimes don't teach enough in residency. Now, you're a professor, you're teaching residents every week. Tell me about your academic role.
Okay, I graduated here in my city as well, and I did my residency in Rio de Janeiro, in the capital. So after I finished residency, I did one more year in my hospital. It's called Hospital dos Servidores do Estado, and I did one more year in cataract. So, I had, as I said before, I didn't have any plan B. I would like to do not only ophthalmology, but also cataract surgery. But I had a very keen professor, a guy who taught me a lot about surgery, about life. And he told me, you should do some kind of retina. I mean, what? I thought, I said, how can I say? I couldn't thought about it at the time. Yeah. And I said, why? Why do you want me to do that? I said, you don't have any, I live in a small city compared to the capital, to Rio, okay? And at that time, we didn't have any retinal specialists in the city. So if my father did a cataract surgery and he got some kind of complications, he would refer to a colleague in the capital. So the logistics about that is kind of complicated and difficult and helps and makes the relation with the patient kind of strange, because the patient said, oh, you're going to send me to another doctor in another city, in another clinic. Okay. So, and he told me about that. You should know, but because you can solve it, if you do the ret, especially the surgical part of it, you will be able to solve it, your cataract issues, without calling anyone. And I thought about that. I thought a lot about that at the time. But I asked him, I can be a cataract and a retinal specialist. And he said, why? Yeah, why not? You just have to study a lot harder and have to go a lot harder than the most of people. So I said, okay, I'll try it. So I went to a congress was in Rio back then. It's like kind of 15 years ago. And I watched some cases of, especially of surgical retina for some specialists. And I was intrigued by the surgery. We didn't, at that time, we didn't see much of vitrectomy in our service. We have it, but we did so few surgeries. We saw a few surgeries back in the time. And I got really fascinated by it. So after I finished my last year on my residency, but my cataract fellowship, I searched for opportunities in surgical retina, and I went to Goiás, it's another state in Brazil, under the tutelage of Professor Marcos Avila, I think you know it. And I spent two years in Goiás, and I did the surgical retina. So In when it was 2012, I went back to Petrópolis, to my city, and started my private practice doing not only cataract, but also vitrectomy.
Yeah, it's very useful for complicated anterior segment cases. You have a trauma case, you have a dislocated IOL, to be able to do a nice three-port pars plana vitrectomy.
It helps a lot.
I don't have that skill. I never learned it. So now, but luckily I'm in a very large city. Los Angeles is very large.
Yeah.
I have retina colleagues who will do a case with me. But you're right. If I look back, maybe 25 years ago, I should have spent an extra year or two doing a retina fellowship also to get better skills.
Yeah. I think if you're looking at other specialties in medicine, if a guy who's operating the belly, doing some kind of surgical, and he has some kind of complications, he would need to solve it, okay? Ophthalmology is very separated.
Yeah.
And if you have some kind of complications, just like a nucleus dropping, you need the retinal specialist. So I think when I learned about how to solve those issues, I got much more secure in doing cataract surgery, and my arsenal of dealing with complications widened a lot.
Right. Yeah, you can do a lot more difficult cases if you've got the skill to do both anterior and posterior segment. But that's unusual. I think very few in the USA, very few cataract surgeons are comfortable doing three-port pars plana vitrectomy. I'd say it's 1%.
Yeah, that professor that I told you before, I asked him, he was a very wise one, and I told him, but vitrectomy is very difficult. Like, is it possible for me to do it? Okay, and he told me something that I've never forget. He said, if you're doing cataract surgery, if you can do a Rexis, surely you can do some vitrectomy. It's easier. I mean, what? And he said, yeah, it's easier. Cataract is the most difficult surgery in ophthalmologists. And I mean, say, no, you can be serious. People are telling about macular peeling, ILM peeling, and it looks very, very complicated. And he said, no, cataract is the most difficult, I tell you. So if you can do cataract surgery just like you're doing now, you will handle vitrectomy as well.
Yeah, I think it's too late for me. I'm after age 50. So after age 50, I think I can't do any more training.
Andrew, nowadays you got Dr. Prasad to got your back on it. Okay,
right.
So if you had any complications, you just call him. He's your friend, and he'll take your nucleus off.
Right. No, for sure. And even I have other retina colleagues. Dr. Prasad is amazing, but I can even do combined cases the same day if it's a complex case. I'll say, why don't we do the case together? Patient's going to need a vitrectomy. The IOL is dislocated. We'll do it together.
And it's fine. Easy. You can manage that.
Right. I've been listening to the Retina Rounds podcast and the Retina Rounds videos. And wow, I mean, it's just really amazing. I like how now Dr. Ehsan Rahimi and Dr. Pradeep Prasad discuss the case together. It is so good.
Yeah, I've seen some kind of videos of Dr. Prasad on retinal rounds, and I think he's a very practical one. He explains with so simple with his language. I think everybody, a resident who's starting and a specialist, they can both understand it. So I think it's a very helpful channel.
For sure. Yeah, he's doing a great job with that. Now, how do you spend your time between your private clinic and then with your academic or teaching the residents and fellows?
Okay, basically it would be like, I'm here the main preceptor at your service. We here at the hospital, we have a section regarding the public the public system that we use to do the practice of the residents, okay? So I would divide it like kind of 70% of my time in the private one, the private sector, and 30% of my time I deal with the residents. For I would say half and half of the time I've spent with them, it's with the clinic practice. I usually we discuss some cases. I see some patients, some complicated ones, and I also do surgery with them one day a week.
Oh, fantastic! So with residents, you've seen in the last 10 or 15 years, they've changed a lot. Residents today are amazing. They learn so fast. They grew up playing video games. The hand-eye coordination is superb. And they watch all these videos. So by the time they come, they've seen so much.
Yeah. The arsenal of them is much bigger than ours. That when I was doing resident, when you were doing resident probably, if you wanted to see somebody who's doing a fantastic surgery, a great technique that you didn't do or you didn't know you want to know about it, you need to go to them. Okay. If I wanted to watch your surgery, I would have no option than to fly over to the United States and watch your surgery, be in your operating room. But with the technology at our hand, it's much easier. So I can watch you. I can watch other doctors. I can watch basically anyone I like and I want to know about their technique in my home, in my living room, in my bedroom. Okay, with my cell phone, with my laptop. So I think they have the technology helped them a lot. They have so much. Their difficulties are a little less than our time back then.
Right, they have access to all this information. When I was a resident, I had to borrow those videotapes from Bobby Osher, who is my idol. I love him.
Yeah, I read his book, The ABCs of Real Surgery, and he had lots of photos of him editing videos in their videotape. I can't even see. I don't remember that. When I was in the last years of the residency, I remember that we used to record the surgery videos in CD. Okay, we don't do that anymore.
Right. Right. When I was when I first started my practice, I used to record surgeries on DV tape, digital video tape. Then after five, six years, then I went to DVDs.
Yes.
It's still low definition.
I got the DVDs. So we did some surgeries back then and we recorded it. And I watched it with my father all the time and we discussed it. So today is a lot easier. So if the surgery is already recorded, we can put it in the net system on the computer network. Okay, so it's a lot easier. And also, we have, if you want to know anything about, I'm having difficulty with anterior vitrectomy. Okay, dude, just go to YouTube and watch vitrectomy basics. Okay, if you have difficult dealing with a posterior capsule rupture, okay, you just go to your channel or other channel, and there's lots of options, lots of surgeries, and lots of surgeons who showing their technique and their way of solving it.
Right. No, there's so much to be learned now. I think the nice part is that it equalizes the surgical education. So no matter where you are in the whole world, as long as you have your mobile phone, you can watch the video in high definition and learn.
Sure, with any specialist in the world. I mean, I can watch you. I can watch Deepak Magur in India and anybody I want in Japan, anywhere I want. So the technology, as I said before, it helps us a lot.
For sure. And then one of the top parts though is there's so much variety. Like if you go to YouTube now and you want to see, okay, I want to show me a white cataract case, there's got to be thousands and thousands of videos.
Yeah, there's a term that the people used to use nowadays. It's very interesting one. So we have a lot of information and a lot more that we can digest. And there's a term that they use called brain obesity. So we had so much info. So you have to be able. It's a main skill we all need nowadays. You have to be able to filter those information and to get what is important, what's really important for you.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of information out there. But, you know, it's also quite impressive that the residents today learn everything that we learned, plus all the new things in the same amount of time. Because in the last 20 years, how many new things came to ophthalmology? They learn all that also, plus the old stuff.
Yeah, I started the residency. They're starting to developing the foldable IOL. So right. I started phaco using rigid lenses. So it's very different. The phaco was much more harsh than it was now. It hadn't got any torsional anterior vitrectomy. Nobody did it back then. Okay, we use only the venous scissor to cut it the vitreous, and you pray a lot to get that to work. Okay, so it's a lot different. And they, as you said, they are quite capable of learning those new techniques and those new tech that are disposable for us.
What are the challenges, do you think, the new or young residents have these days that we didn't have? What's different?
I think in one hand, they got all of these advantages of the technology, as I said, as we said. But I think a main issue for them nowadays that probably is happening the same in the United States in here, because the amount of med schools here in Brazil, they exploded in the last year. So we got tons of medics getting graduated year by year. And the amount of residency spots, the residency positions, they stayed much like the same. So the funnel gets narrower, and people are having difficulty to learn ophthalmology. So the competition about residency spots is very difficult these days here. So I think it's a main issue. And other main issue is when they finish the residency, as I said, they are not prepared to do surgery. So they need to stick to a service that they can keep training while they're doing their private practice. And there's a lot of people who graduated residency and they stay there. So there's kind of not so much healthy competition between residents and post-residents to stay at the same place. I think in the time we're going to have some more surgeries in the future, and they'll have some difficult set. Also, I think the one main issue is something that bothers me a lot. When we had doubts in our past, and we asked our staff, our professors, they used to say, okay, you just go to the book and read it, okay? And what I'm seeing right now, I'm seeing some difficulties for them to go after some more antique versions of getting knowledge, just like the books. They always used to ask me, saying, oh, I can't see. Is there any video on YouTube regarding that? I see. Yeah, maybe, probably. So, but I said, but you just get the book and study it. Okay, it will be the active effort for you doing it will be a lot harder, and it will get you better. You are learning just like we learned back in our time.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. Good points. In the U.S. also, there are only about 500 positions per year for residency for ophthalmology in the U.S. And I think the last cycle, 900 or almost 1,000 applied for it. So it's like only 50% chance of getting it.
And the other problem we see here, it's the last years, the searching for ophthalmology kept rising, because you got some advantages. They always tell this joke that, oh, ophthalmologists, they earn more than the other specialists in medicine. So it's a common joke we say here. But the problem is much like the same as yours. Okay, we have so much more spots on med schools, and we don't have the proportional spots on residency here.
Right. I think it's very similar. That's a pretty common problem. In fact, if you look at worldwide data, we're not producing enough ophthalmologists for the world.
Yeah, I saw that.
That means we need to each become even more and more efficient. I think a lot of the Brasileiros, the Brazilians, are really fantastic at efficiency. I mean, some of these systems are amazing.
Yeah, I saw recently the surgery from Dr. Kuitko in your channel.
Sure. Sergio.
The guy did this with the corneal opacity. It was a very difficult case back there.
Yes, Sergio is an amazing surgeon. I went to visit him in Brazil, in Porto Alegre.
Wow, yes.
He's a super skilled surgeon. Very, very amazing guy.
Yeah, he has a lot of experience. I think he's older than me. I think I remember him when I was a resident watching him teaching at congresses. And he's a very good one. We have a lot of I think one of the main reasons that we have so much good surgeons here is that because we're dealing with more advanced cataracts than as you like to say in Los Angeles. Our cataracts are harder than Los Angeles.
Right.
So it toughens up the surgeons.
Oh, for sure. Well, that's absolutely for sure. I think for me, normally Beverly Hills cataracts are pretty straightforward, but in my case, I get referred a lot of patients. So I still do a dense or brunescent cataract or white cataract every week, but there are like some surgeons, like you'll be in parts of Brazil, I'm sure you'll do 10 white cataracts this week. It's all we every day.
Yeah, because we tend to think, and I usually tell the residents, see, if you're thinking that when you finish residents, you won't have hard and complicated cataracts, think again, because you're wrong. You're going to get it. People come to your office asking for you to do surgery in these complex or difficult cases, and you need to deal with it. You don't have any options back there. So, and when time passes, I'm in this game kind of like 20 years, as I said. People tend to come to your office because you're a specialist and your fame kept rising. And they came with much more harder cataracts. I mean, not much harder cataracts, complicated cases, and it's one of the main traits you have to deal with. Okay, it's you can run from it.
That is true. Now, later in my career, I get a lot more very difficult cases, more than I did 10 or 15 years ago. Yeah. And so now patients will look online. Oh, they know they have a very difficult case.
Yeah,
and they do some little homework. They look it up on Google and they say, "Oh, I need to see this guy."
Yeah, they see your name on the internet and they say, "Okay, he's a specialist. I had a complicated case." And we're seeing these days another main issue that our colleagues, many of them, they are trying to run away from these complex cases. People don't want to be bothered by it, so they tend to operate, to do surgery in the more the cases with the medium difficulty. And if they have some kind of problem, small dilation, Bruneson and cataracts, just like you said, they tend to refer to another specialist. So those things tend to concentrate on us.
Right, that's true. For me, the most stressful cases are obviously like zonulopathy.
Yeah.
But I think for me, it's the nanophthalmos. The very tiny eyes, the amount of stress with those cases is so high. It's just.
Fortunately, they're kind of rare comparing to the other cases, but nano, they are tough cases and we have to manage. We don't do what we want in those eyes. We do what the eye permits us to do. Right. That's the truth. If you're dealing with some kind of cases, the eye permits some things for you to do. You don't do whatever you want in those cases.
That is true. Yeah, I had and even more difficult, even the refractive outcome, as you know, on those tiny eyes, it's just so inaccurate. I had a patient I did recently, beautiful case, preoperatively plus 10 refraction for distance, tiny eye. Iowa Power was, I believe, like 38, 40 doctors. So I do the surgery. Patient ends up minus 0.5. And I thought, what an amazing thing. And the patient is so upset because they're so used to myopia. Even the minus a half of myopia, they don't want.
Yeah, the problem is that he has the hyperopic brain, okay? He spends all his life thinking in hyperopia, right?
Yes.
And he finishes the surgery with degrees of myopia. His brain doesn't understand at all.
Right. So it's interesting is that, now this patient wears glasses. He wears minus, he's minus a half, but he mirrors, overcorrects himself. So he ends up being plus a half.
Yeah. The same thing happens with high myopia. If you operate a patient with a high myopia and he finished the surgery with some residual hyperopia, even if it's a smaller one, he will hate you for the rest of his life.
Very, very true.
Yeah. He'll hate you.
Well, the hyperopic one also, you got to remember this caught me years ago. I made this mistake. I didn't explain to the patient ahead of time enough that you're wearing plus 6 or plus 8 glasses. Everything is big. When you look, you have the magnification. When I put the Iowa Power in your eye, even if you end up plano, ametropia, or plus a half, you're going to lose the magnification. It's going to be normal size.
Yeah, he's going to
say to me, they say, I'm happy with the vision, but they say, everything looks small.
Yeah, he's going to see smaller things right now because he spends all his life doing living with those glasses, and he sees the images bigger, right? It's a problem.
Yeah, I think half of what we do is just trying to meet expectations of the patient.
Yeah, People used to, there's a term that we are also familiar. It's called the chair time, right? Okay, you need to spend some time in your chair with the patient, explaining him about, and this minimizes a lot of problems in your practice, right? And I used to, I tend to use another expression. I tend to use the share time. You need to share your time with the patient, okay? Because our lives are so, we are so occupied, our practice is so busy, so we tend to think that the patient understands the surgery just like we did. So if we don't explain it well to the patient they kept returning, complaining, okay, I didn't know about that, we didn't know about it, and it complicates things a little.
Yes, for sure. I think we gotta spend enough time to really set appropriate patient expectations. I think that's really important part of it. Now, what advice do you give? You're training the young residents and fellows now, and they're going to start practice. What's the best advice you can give to young ophthalmologists who are just starting their private clinic or just starting their career?
Those who are starting, I would tell them that just simply don't quit surgery. We think that people tend to go a lot well in surgeries, especially in cataract, when we don't have any kind of complication. But the complications will arrive as well, even if we don't want it. Right. And what I'd like to tell them is that they don't quit. If you learn to endure the pain of dealing with complications, with difficult patients, you will grow and you will learn to deal with it. The main difficult thing for us to continue is not the general problems we used to say, but the problem of keep going and enduring the pain, because even us, we should have a lot of time doing surgery, we deal with those kinds of problems. We have complicated patients in our private practice. People who were starting, they used to think, okay, their office is perfect. They don't have any problems. Their life is peachy, okay? But it's not like that. We have problems. And I think I have much more problems than I had when I started, because I take much more responsibility dealing with complex cases. So what I used to say to them, to the younger ones who finished residency, is just don't quit. Learn to deal with the pain. Because you will grow and you get stronger mind, especially with your mind, and to deal with those cases. So I think this is the most difficult issue, because I see a lot of people who don't want to do that. They're disencouraging the younger ones. Okay, don't do that. Don't mess with that. You get a lot of complications. Don't bother with that. Refer to anybody. And I used to think differently. Saying you need to take up responsibility and deal with that. If you're having a difficult case, if you need help, I can help you dealing with that. But you have to take responsibility for that, because, as I said before, we in residents, if we have a complication, we just refer. We refer to the specialists in retina. We refer to the specialists in glaucoma or the corneal specialist. It doesn't matter. But we tend to refer. And we kept going. In the private practice, we can have this luxury, okay? If you had a problem, you can refer, okay? But the patient will only remember you because it was you who did the surgery.
Right. That's so true. Yeah. That's very challenging. Certainly, the first few years of practice are going to be much more difficult than you imagine. When you're a resident, there's so much hand-holding, so much safety net. When you start your practice, you don't have that.
Yeah, I think the main issue is for you to get a proper plan for you to start, okay? Of course, if you can deal with such complex cases, if you're doing a difficult surgery, of course you get hammered. Of course, you had a higher chance of getting complications. So when you do those cases, you need to get a more experienced friend or a more experienced colleague near you, okay? And also, I'd like to play and say the best thing for you to do is be a friend with a retinal specialist. You never know when you're going to need them.
All right. That's for sure. That's what I say. Share the love and share the liability with your
retinal. Yeah.
But that's very true. There's some hard lesson to be learned. I think I realized that in life, every year is a little bit more difficult than the previous year. I'm still waiting for the years where maybe this year will be easier than last year. It doesn't happen.
No, the golden years, they're past. Okay, the best moment in your life. You think you're not getting any difficulties. Oh, this year's gonna be awesome. I won't get any problems. But you're wrong. You're getting more problems, and problems, they come up with the amount of responsibility you take for your life. It's not only applied to ophthalmology or medicine. I think it is applied to life. The moment you take more responsibility for it, the more complex and the more amount of problems you're going to get. So it's a trait that we all have to deal with. And I think I used to tell, I can tell, I also tell the residents the same. If you're going to the cataract surgery, only thinking about the money, because if you're doing surgery, we tend to earn more, okay? That's basic, okay? We're doing more riskier things, so we tend to earn a little more. But if you are going to the surgery only thinking about the money, the surgery won't do well for you, okay? Because when you get complications, you're going to say, the money I'm earning, it isn't worth the risk.
Right.
The risk is greater than the money. But if you're thinking about the perks that you can gain with the surgery, you're getting a strong mindset, you're dealing with the sense of responsibility, with your ownership, dealing with those problems. I think those capacities, those skills, they're gonna expand for all out of the operating room. You can, and they're very useful for you to very other aspects of your life.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And then once you think of your problems when you're young and you're doing your training is only ophthalmology related. But the next thing you know, you've got personal issues. You've got the family issues. You've got a girlfriend issues. Next thing you know, you have to buy this house. You have to go into debt. Next thing you know, you have some kids. Now the kids are a lot more work. Next thing you know, you start getting older. Now you become presbyopic. Oh, when presbyopia hit.
Yeah, it's happening to me now. It's happening to me now. Right. I understand a lot. I'm starting to widen up the arm to read. And people are playing with us, okay? And we have to deal with that. And the problems are getting just bigger by the time. I think I always reflect about the issue of problems. And I think if you're thinking that to have peace in your life, it's not having problems, you're going the wrong way. I think the best path for peace would be for you to understand that the problems are going to come, whether you like it or not. And you have to become more stronger to deal with them. And you have to have a strong philosophy to deal with them. I think it helps a lot, not only in ophthalmology, but also in our life as well.
Yes, right. The goal is not having no problems, because that's impossible. The goal is being able to deal with the problems that you have.
If you look at people who are quitting or quit surgery, you can see a pattern very specific, I think. You see those, they had a complication in a difficult case. So they short their bar. They're doing easier surgeries than they did before. But in the meantime, they had a complication in those easier surgery, or their more common surgeries, and they lower the bar again. So there comes a time when they're doing the most common and routine case, a soft cataract, a good dilation, and it will happen for you to have a complication also in these cases. So they opt out the surgery, and they opt to do, they chose to do the most easier path, who is what? Not to do the surgery, okay? Right. So the problem is, if you kept going this path, you're going to lower your bar of difficulties in with every aspect of the problems in your life, okay? You're going to be at your medical office, and you're going to, I won't do any cases regarding advanced glaucoma, okay? I won't treat those patients. I won't instill drops to dilate the pupil, because I can have acute glaucoma, okay? Right. So you're going to lower progressively, you're going to lower your bar, and you're going to do much more easier things. So I think the easier path...
The easier path is not the right answer. The easy way out to lower your standards is not what you want.
because I'm not asking people to do residents, young residents or young post residents to do the most evil and complex cases, just like the nano that you said before. What I'm asking is you need to do progressively much a little more difficult. And those progressive little more difficult will help get you better. Okay, nobody's asking you to do an eye without dilation, for example, or nobody's asking you for do a case with zonulopathy. Okay, but we're asking you to just keep going, doing some difficult things, and you get better by the time. So if you increase progressively the difficulty in the surgeries, we can make them better. I used to quote a teacher that I had in residency. He was awesome. And he said, there was a colleague of mine who she was the most courageous one. He'd do it everything and anything. He wouldn't back off any. She wouldn't back off anything. And that guy, everybody loves her. Everybody admires her. She was so courageous. And that professor of mine, he used to say, I don't like her technique. He was the only one. I mean, and I asked him, why don't you like it? He's so, because she doesn't have any fear at all. And I said, but isn't that a good thing? Do not have fear. And he said, of course, if you have full fear, it will be a problem for you to deal with surgery. But it's important for you to have a little bit of fear, because that little bit of fear that we all have nowadays, okay? That little bit of fear keeps you sharp in the surgery. It makes you less arrogant. It makes you a bit more attentive in the surgery and make you commit less mistakes. So I completely agree with him about that little bit of fear. And I tend to teach people about the importance of you having that small little bit fragment of fear. That small little bit, it helps you a lot to get less arrogant, to be more attentive, to be more active in your surgery, paying attention.
That is for sure true. You have to have a little bit of fear, a little bit of caution. If you have zero fear and zero caution, you can actually get in a lot of trouble.
I think there's another lesson that you can learn in surgery is everything that runs in extremes, it's bad for us, okay? If you are operating an eye with a high myopia, people with like 20 degrees of myopia, people tend to think, oh, that's an awesome eye to operate. There's a lot of space in it, okay? And it's not much kind of that. The problem is that their eyes are so deep that you have difficulty to do fractured or to sculpt a groove or even you to do the rexes, okay? The same thing applies to the other extreme, just like the nanophthalmos that you said, okay? Those tiny eyes, small dilation, difficult to get spaces, okay? So in the eye, everything that's too much tends to complicate things a little.
Mm-hmm. The extremes.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I know for sure. If it's extreme, that's an issue. But yeah, I like your idea that you have to push yourself a little bit. It's kind of like going to the gym to lift weights.
Yeah, totally.
You have to grow, to get stronger and have bigger muscles. You have to push yourself a little bit more every time.
I'm a big fan I'm a big fitness fan. I frequent a lot of gym. And I think there are many analogies or many parallels we can draw between weightlifting, as you said, and cataract surgery, okay? First of all, you can grow your muscles without failing them, okay? If you are a weighting lift and you don't fail, then you can make the muscle, you're gonna get difficulties getting hypertrophy in those muscles, okay? So, but if you put it such a way that you can handle it, okay, it won't do well for you because you won't be able to lift it, okay? So the main issue is if you can increase just a little the difficult, and is the thing I love to do with the residents, especially the older ones. They're operating and I'm in the room and I'm just smiling, looking at the surgery. I didn't enter yet. And when they're getting the trypan blue, I said, no, you won't use it that. But I get them in surprise. It helps a lot. They're so frightened when you said that. And I said, okay, now you're doing a spirorexis. Okay. I will never ask a resident of the second year to do that with learning to do a Rexis, to do a normal routine cataract surgery. But the older ones, the more experienced ones, I used to do that. And this element of surprise, this introduction of the surprise element, it helps them a lot because they learn how to get tougher with the surgery.
For sure. Absolutely. That's a really great analogy there. Now tell me about what else are your other interests outside of ophthalmology? I know you're very athletic. You're also into martial arts.
Yeah, yeah. I practice karate since I was 15 years old, and now I'm a black belt instructor, 15. And I started for like 4 years ago judo because I wanted to learn another martial arts. I thought I was becoming a little softer, a little more comfortable with the cataract, with the karate, and I started judo with karate, and it's a very demanding endeavor, and I'm having a lot of pain, a lot of fun with it because I'm getting a little hammered yet with the judo, and I chose judo because it's very different from the karate. Okay, it's another different kind of martial arts, and I think the martial arts would be the practicing of martial arts. It's one of the most important things I've ever decided in life, and I think the martial arts as well. They help me a lot dealing with the problems regarding my medical practice because, as I said, we had a lot of perils there. Both surgery and martial arts, both are so much demanding, both require a lot of time, a lot of practice, and both cause you a great lot of pain, okay? In martial arts, you got physical pain as well, but the mental pain that you got is kind of harsh as well. And I think I practice a lot, and I suggest to people to do it because you get so much many benefits from martial arts. I think because one of the obvious perks on it is the physical issue. Okay, you got more healthier, you got more thinner, but I think you get more confident when you learn how to deal with violence, the possibility of violence with another people. Okay, I never encourage people to practice or to use martial arts without the means of self-defense. But when you have a situation when some people show hostility to you, physical hostility, you're not you know you're able to defend yourself. So it helps you being more confident and also be able to deal more with those chaotic situations that can happen all the time.
Now, tell me, I don't know, what is the difference between karate and judo? How are they different? How are they similar?
Karate, both are Japanese, okay? But karate is kind of like a striker one, just like Muay Thai and boxing. You use your fists and also your feet. You can use elbows or knees. But judo we call the judo style with the grappling, okay? It's like jiu-jitsu. The Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So, but judo, you don't fight it only on the floor. You get to pick up your opponent and throw him. Okay, so judo, yeah, the jiu-jitsu, the jiu-jitsu, he evolutes after the judo because the judo creates the style of the defense in the floor. Okay, I chose judo because it's a very different martial arts from karate, and I thought the challenge was up for me, and I tried to. The striking one, I think, would be easier, like boxing or Muay Thai, so I chose another one to get out of my comfort zone.
Wow, that's great. Like, same way you like cataracts, and you say that I'm going to do some retina training now.
Yeah.
Very similar, a lot of parallels.
I think when I started judo, I was in a time of my life that I was in a very comfortable position in everything I did. Okay, I have experience in karate. I'm still learning, but I have much less to learn than when I started. Okay, and I used to train people there in karate now in our dojo, and my private practice was doing quite well back then. And I started to become a little more preoccupied with those risks, with those, and I started to become more centered in my comfort zone. And I used to say that our comfort zone is not a circle. It's like kind of a spiral which is rotating, and we need to keep pushing you, keep forcing it for in forward, because when you don't do it, you get complacent. It's like running a treadmill, if you think about it. Okay, if you stay still in the treadmill, you're gonna get pushed behind. Okay, so you don't have any options about that. So I think that we all need to push forward our comfort zone, even if it's outside of ophthalmology, because it helps us a lot to grow in every aspect of it. And I think you can just separate the professional aspect of your life, the ophthalmology, with those aspects. I think they tend to correlate. Okay, so I can think of me in my private practice, in my routine day of surgery, I can think of me doing what I do now, like a lot of surgeries in one day. I can think about doing that without some physical help, or I can think doing that without being physical fit to do it. So if I back in the day when I was a little fatter, when it's a little comfortable, I did a lot less of surgeries in the day, and after I finished it, I just collapsed in my bed and said, okay, the day's over. Now with my training, with my physical training, I can endure the day as well, and I hit the gym just after it. Okay, I can handle it. Okay, so I think the physical aspect is so much important. Also, you can have mental fortitude, you can have mental resilience without training hard. You can have it without having a good physique. It's not much. It's not a question of aesthetics. Okay, you need to do it because both are correlated. You can have a strong mind with a weak body, and the inverse as well.
Very, very true. A lot of parallels between the two.
A lot,
for sure. It is. Yeah, I think it's an important part of having a good long career is pushing yourself, but also it's the consistency. The same way, you know, you don't just go to the gym once in a while. You've got to make a plan to go every single week, many times a week, and stay with it. The consistency is what pays off.
And you can expand this for all of aspects of life. If you're analyzing the cataract training, just like we're saying, you can be an amazing surgeon. We use an expression in Brazil that the older ones use it, just like my father. They used to say, he can't operate because he doesn't have the hand, which means the talent, the natural manual skill for him to do it. And I think I used to say that manual skill is worth nothing to the prepared. The only thing that matters is for you to keep going the game, keep pushing it, okay? Mm-hmm. There's a good author, I think he's American, that Malcolm Gladwell. One of his books is saying about the 10,000 hour rule, which he means, I think Robert Greene just said that. He says, if you want to be master in anything you want to do, it, you need to practice for 10,000 hours. It applies to everything we do in life. It applies for you in martial arts. Yeah. It applies for you in cataract surgery, okay? If you're practicing and you do a very good surgery in your first time, okay, you have that hand, you have that talent, okay, that will mean nothing if you can't practice. I always use to quote an example of another colleague who did residence with me, that he was amazing. He was a beast. And he, at his first surgery, he was doing an extracapsular surgery. He did it all by himself. Nobody helped him in that surgery. And I thought, man, the guy's awesome. He will be a master on it. And I think some weeks have passed, a month, kind of. And I asked him when we were taking breakfast together, I say, hey, how's it going? How's the surgery? You're kicking ass again, right? And he said, no, I just quit. And I mean, why? You did you have any complications? Do you have any problems in the surgery? And he said, no, everything was just fine. So why did you quit? And he said, I think I don't want to handle the pressure with cataract. I think it's too demanding for me. So he's for me the best example that the hand, as my father used to say, the hand means nothing in surgery. I think the hand is like running. I think the everything we're doing is like kind of ultra marathon. It's kind of 100 kilometers. The guy who has the hands, he starts like 100 meters before everybody. But okay, he has to run 100 kilometers, even that. Okay, so I think the talent that that manual thing, the hand that said, it's much less important than the stomach. Of course, it helps. But the, if the guy has though that the talent and he has and he practice, he has discipline, he has the method. Okay, he'll become a great surgeon. Okay, we all know that. But the experience I had dealing with those guys, those handy guys, they tend to be a lot more attentive than the less handy ones. They tend to think, okay, I have ability, I don't have to train a lot, okay? And I see it happens a lot.
Yeah, that's true. It is not easy what we've done. We've got to work hard at it. It's a mental game, it's a physical game, and it's a long game.
The most important thing is not the hands, it's the stomach. You need to stomach the things that you're going to have to endure, okay? If you have the stomach and the stomach also with the hands, the stomach can be trained as well. When I teach, I say, I think there's a three-pillar method where I teach with, I call the three M's, okay? It's the mind, it's the method, and it's the many, okay? Many is the train. You need to train. If you don't train, you can do it. But you have to prepare your mind. And people used to say, but what if I don't have the strong mind? I said, the mind can be trained as well. There's a very good study in psychology. I think I read it in a good book called The Art of Resilience. And the guy, the Ross Edgley, is a British author. He said, two psychologists, they study, and they call the study the habituation of stress. It's a very interesting one. And I think it's very useful for us in our profession. In this study, they submit submit people to a stressor stimulus. They don't specify which one was that, okay? And he realized that the results would be one group would be less reactive to that stimulus in time, and the other group would become more reactive to the stimulus. Mm-hmm. When they analyzed those two groups, they found something quite interesting. They couldn't find any biological factors regarding them. Okay, they didn't say genetics, biochemistry, anything that could justify that. The only factor, the only variable that they could find that could separate those groups were the interpretation of the process, the subjectivity. Mm. Those people who said that stressor, that stimulus will get me stronger, they got stronger. And the other people, I can't handle it, it's going to get worse, they got worse, they got more reactive with that stressor. So I think the mind could and can be trained if you taught people. So the main issue would be, you can put a lot of difficulties for the guy who's signing. You can ask for a resin in the second year. Okay, just do it a Bernstein cataract, okay? A white one. We all agree with that. But if you do, you put it some a little difficult, a little more difficult, a little, you're adding a little more difficult, he will get better. And that's what that's why I strongly advocate that we should all train in regular eyes, and we should avoid, of course, you should initiate with a simulation. But the main problem with the simulation is you don't have any risk regarding that. So if you rupture the capsule, you rupture the capsule, okay, you should try it. I also start with simulation with them. Okay, but if you had a complication, what's the setback? Well, you don't have any consequence of that, okay? You don't have to see the patient the day after, right? You all know that. But if you put the patient, if you put the resident doing a little more difficult step than that he did the last week or the day before, he will get stronger by the time. So if you progressively increase that difficulty, they will get better and they will learn to train their mind to be stronger. So I think the method that mostly works is you prepare the mind for the resident. The method, I think it's a very, very, very important issue, because I remember when I was doing surgery, the first ones, and I asked a teacher when I was doing Rexes, and he said, I said, how am I supposed to do that? He said, "You put the forceps in the eye and just rotate it." And I said, "But how?" I said, "How?" He said, right. "How can I do that?" I said, "No, just put it, just close the forceps and do it, okay? It's easier." I, well, okay, that's how. So I think the method can needs to be as simpler as possible. I think the method you can use with your residents should be the you have to a non-medical person has to understand what you're doing. If the method is simple, they will understand. And people tend to confuse simplicity with lack of complexity. Okay, sophistication, as Bruce Lee used to say, is the most. I think he said is the most. Simplicity is the most sophisticated form of teaching. I think it was a quote of him. So I think the method would be simple. It should be precise. That's a thing that I insist a lot with them. And the last part is would be the manual, the training. This tripod approach. It doesn't work separately. Okay? If I wanted to learn the guitar, I can't just pick. I just can't pick the instrument and just tap in the chords to learn the song. I need to have a method, okay? I need to know which chords do those sounds, okay? I'm not a musical guy. But if I don't have a method, I can train as many hours as I want, but I don't get results. So I think you can teach anything, not just cataract surgery, but also anything in life you can teach without getting a simply method, okay? You can without the problems of the dealing with the mind issues and without the practice. Karate is just like the same, okay? You have to train a lot. You have to prepare mind because you're going to get punched. You're going to get kicked. So you need to deal with that because it's horrible and it's nobody likes to be punched. Nobody likes to get kicked, okay? If you are getting kicked, it will affect you. It will make you weaker. So why in the training when I'm dealing suppose with a white belt and he looks at me with my black belt and he's completely frightened, he's completely scared, the first thing I do with him is just keep calm and we're gonna keep fighting, you don't get hurt, don't you worry. And we change, we need to trade some punches and some kicks, but very slowly for him to get used to. Right. In the meantime, he's gonna get evolution, he's gonna get better, he's gonna get much more darker belts, and when he gets to the brown belt or even a purple belt is one much more advanced, then we keep pushing him with more strength, with more speed, and but his is already used. If you get that white belt and I started a fight with the same intensity as I do with my master, okay, he will collapse and he'll never return to the dojo. So it won't work.
So same way with the resident. Don't start off with the small pupil, pseudo exfoliation, sonulopathy, burness, and cataract.
No, that's a bad idea.
Well, this has been such a great time talking to you. What great bits of advice you have here for young doctors. It's really been, I can't believe we've been talking for more than 1 hour already.
Yeah, just this kind of 1 hour. I think, Yudai, that... our main issue is for us to teach the residents the way, fulfilling the flaws that we didn't like in our time. And I used to think that here in Brazil, as you said it before in one of your videos, we had sometimes when we don't have any professors teaching with us. We had the plus resident with me in the cataract. So my main philosophy teaching is I don't do with them what they did to me, okay? And it works a lot, and they like it a lot because they're getting help and they're getting the proper orientation in that.
Well, I think you're doing a great job. It's really been an amazing time talking to you. Thank you for taking the time to spend talking with us on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, wherever you find a podcast. Of course, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. We have a new Cataract Coach video every single day coming up to video 3000 July. So it's coming very soon. And of course, check out our sister channel. We talked about Retina Rounds with Dr. Pradeep Prasad, where we have podcasts, but also videos so you can learn retina surgery. So until next time, I'll catch you later.